Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, now celebrating their 125th anniversary. From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. This year, Hanukkah and Christmas come hot on each other's heels. The 8-day Jewish Festival of Lights began on December 16th and will conclude on Christmas Eve, just as the Christian celebration kicks into high gear. African-American Judaic scholar Michael Tweedy joins us with his twist on Hanukkah. Then, Creole caterer Bertha Pishon makes sure that our menu is kosher before Jill Benson takes us to Natchitoches for Louisiana's special celebration of lights. We're wishing you a happy Hanukkah and a very Merry Christmas on this week's Louisiana Eats. For over 40 years, if you were planning a catered affair for kosher guests in New Orleans, your caterer was most likely to be Bertha Pishon. Mrs. Pishon, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Thank you. I'm honored.
And if you don't mind, I'm going to call you Bertha.
Not at all.
Now, how in the world did a Creole Catholic young woman make it into the kosher kitchen?
Well, because everybody was a caterer doing the own thing. So I'm saying to myself, if I have to work this hard, I'm going to become a kosher caterer. I just had to find out the restrictions because I knew they were strict. One time, that was a bad word, kosher.
Really?
For years, nobody knew I was a kosher caterer because you'd say, I'm a kosher caterer. Say, what that mean? You know, and I didn't want to explain all that. I didn't want to tell them it took 7 years for me to be accepted through an Orthodox rabbi. And I was young, believe me.
How old were you when you started working?
That's a bad question. I've been working since I'm about 10 or 11. But in the food business, I was about 23 or 24. I wanted to be a dietitian, but they couldn't afford to send me to school. Then I went and learned to serve parties with Lucy Ada.
And who was that?
Lucy Ada was a wonderful person. She worked and served for the Jews, but she didn't do kosher work. They had a Jewish woman, Miss Bloomberg, she was making the kosher food, but she was older then. So she asked me, Miss Pishon, would you like to come in do kosher foods? And she didn't have to teach me to cook. She just had to teach me the fundamentals and the restrictions. I worked in Beth Israel Synagogue.
That was the old original one on Carondelet Street.
Exactly.
And I believe at that time that was one of the very largest Orthodox congregations in New Orleans. Isn't so you were cooking for the Orthodox Jews.
Yes, ma'am.
Now, what did that entail?
That entailed that I couldn't bring one package in there open.
Okay.
Everything I bought, I had to bring it sealed. In the beginning, I bought a lot of kosher meat from Mr. Ralph Rosenblatt, the only kosher butcher that I knew of in New Orleans. So then after the rabbi recommended me to do this ufruf.
What is that?
Ufruf is a breakfast or luncheon, something like a bar mitzvah, bat mitzvah. But it's for the groom. It's before he get married. So that was my very big first experience. And I went to Mr. Ralph, and I said, Mr. Ralph, I have to have such and such a thing. Okay, Miss Pishon, we got everything. And they wanted me to be successful. I had a lot of nice Jewish people that wanted me to be successful. But, of course, they didn't have a kosher caterer. Miss Bloomberg was getting older, and she was about to retire. So I did my ufruf. This was for Molly Penner's daughter.
Okay.
I'll remember that as long as I live. They were all nervous for me. You know, it was a big job.
And how many people were you feeding?
I think it was about 200 or
200. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. But I played many penance to be an Orthodox caterer.
Yes.
After they open your products.
And the rabbi has to open it.
Yeah.
You can't open up your own product.
No, if I did, I'd have to take it out.
Oh.
And they called him a mishkia. He was a supervisor over all the foods. And I'd lay my products down, and he'd open them, and then I'm ready to go.
So you couldn't bring any food in that you had already prepared. Everything had to be prepared there on the spot.
Exactly.
And what were the facilities like?
Well, the facilities had two kitchens, a milk kitchen and a meat kitchen. You know, the rule is you can't, even though I was all checked out and had everything, I had to work in a meat kitchen.
Uh-huh.
And in a meat kitchen, you couldn't put no cheese or nothing down in there. You know, their rule in Orthodox is you don't mix milk and meat. I had one experience at Beth Israel.
What was that?
I made a beautiful bar mitzvah. You know, you have to be finished cooking. All fires have to be out 5:30 or whenever sundown comes.
On Friday. Oh, gosh.
So if I would have meatballs, little cocktail meatballs, I would have to leave them on a low fire all night because you can't turn the fires on Saturdays. Whatever flame you put it on Friday evening, have to sit like that till after sundown Saturday night.
Now, that's going to require some special cooking tricks because a lot of things couldn't take that much heat.
Well, I found that out, and guess what?
What?
I didn't fix them on meatballs. Years ago, the prime minister of Israel came in, and of course he had to go to Beth Israel. The rabbi, the head rabbi, asked me, could I make a New Orleans dish? I said, oh, sure, I'd be happy. So what I did, I made red beans, and I made jambalaya. Of course, not with shrimp and crab.
Right.
But at that time, they were starting to have a bigger market with kosher foods in New Orleans.
Yes.
So they started making sausage. When I first started doing kosher, the only thing they made in anything looked like a sausage was a hot dog. Mm. And I made the jambalaya with chicken and sausage. You know, you couldn't use ham.
Right.
And I made red beans with no meat because being a Catholic, my mother cooked red beans on Friday with a lot of seasoning and a lot of butter. So I had learned that from her. And do you know, the rabbi came and asked me, the prime minister, is this kosher? I said, Rabbi, this is Beth Israel Synagogue. I had to have a mishkia to check this out so you could eat it. He said, but it's so good, Miss Bisho. I said, because it's a New Orleans style. It's a Creole style kosher cooking. And they couldn't believe, he couldn't believe it was strictly kosher. He said, okay.
And what about your special hors d'oeuvres? I know that you were really known for your hors d'oeuvres, I've heard.
I did, because, you know, when you went to any luncheon or dinner, even in a hotel, if it was kosher, their first appetizer was some kind of fruit. Any kind of fruit. They never had nothing else. And one day I was sitting down, I said, well, they got to have something else. So I start making trout cocktail.
Trout cocktail. Now, what was that like?
Well, it was same like you would prepare shrimp or fish. I just poached it and took it apart, put that on a bed of lettuce, wedge of lemon, and maybe a little parsley. Then I put the cocktail sauce on the side.
Uh-huh.
And mind you, I had to make my cocktail sauce. You didn't have no kosher cocktail sauce.
Right.
So I bought all the ingredients and I had to have all that okayed by the rabbi. Then I made it. Well, I had to make so many fish cocktails after that because that was such a big hit. You know, they never had nothing but fruits. When I started doing, all they knew was chicken fat, chicken liver, this, that, and that. Now, I improved the chopped chicken liver.
And how did you do that?
Well, I quit using all that chicken fat.
Oh.
See, when Miss Bloomboy was training me, there was some margarines you could use.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, they didn't have canola oil and all that. So I went to the rabbi, and I told him I would like to use some of the margarine with some of the chicken fat. And it did hold the liver a little better.
Mm-hmm.
So I showed it to him, and I made it one day, and he said, ooh, that's good. Yeah, okay, go. Then I couldn't stop making chicken liver.
when you were the caterer for the city of New Orleans, how did you get that job, and what was that job like?
Well, I think because Dutch knew I was doing kosher catering all around.
And, of course, we're talking about Dutch Morial, who was the first black mayor of New Orleans.
Correct. So the first thing he had was not the first Mardi Gras, because that's when the police strike was on.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't have no Mardi Gras. The next one, I did the Mardi Gras for him.
And where was it held? Where was it?
In Galley Hall.
Mm-hmm.
By then, I had my own catering kitchen, not kosher. I got to make that clear. So anyhow, for Dutch, we sat down, and he told me he wanted me to do Mardi Gras. I said, well, fine with me. But Bert, I got to have corned beef. I said, you got it, Mr. Mayor. So we had corned beef, and I got the rye bread. They were making it on those sandwiches, and it was really a big hit for him.
Now, I'm very curious. You were able to introduce so many kosher people, even from Israel, the flavors of Creole cooking. Did any of those kosher tastes and flavors make it the other way back into your home kitchen?
Yes. My son was sick, my oldest son, Walter.
Yes.
So I'm saying to him, I'm going to make you some chicken soup. That'll be good. He said, you know what I want? I want chicken soup with matzo balls. Now, this is not matzo ball time. You know, matzo ball is like for Passover.
Right.
I said, well, you sure gave me a hard order. I got to go see if Joel have matzo meal. Well, I knew he had matzo meal. That's the gourmet kitchen. You know, on Savarin.
Yes.
So that was my order recently, just about 6 months ago. But my family, they used to want to order chopped chicken liver. Mama, can you make some chicken liver for our chaplains? So anything we fix, my children is used to eating kosher foods.
Oh, that's such a great story. Well, I'm so glad we had this chance to have these conversations together, and thank you for welcoming us into your home.
Well, I'm delighted that you thought enough of me to come in.
Thank you, Miss Pichon.
Now, would you like a piece of matzo ball?
Bertha Pichon, New Orleans Catholic Creole kosher caterer. When we come back, the Hanukkah celebration continues with New Orleans kosher Creole cookbook author Mildred Covert. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Lifelong New Orleanian Mildred Covert is the queen of kosher Creole cooking. With Sylvia Gerson, Mildred co-authored the definitive books on how to taste Creole and Cajun while keeping kosher. For years, Mildred was a contributing columnist to the Times-Picayune. Her fresh take on food for the Jewish holidays has inspired generations of kosher cooks. Mildred is here with us to talk about a New Orleans-style Hanukkah. Mildred, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Well, thank you so much. What a wonderful introduction. I hope I live up to it.
I want to start with a little history. How did your grandmother keep kosher from the moment she stepped off the boat?
Well, it was very interesting because that's all the Jews in those days that came. They all automatically kept kosher. And when she came down here to New Orleans, of course, this was a whole new culinary experience. Some things were comical, other things were very serious. And like what I call the Jews for centuries all over the country, they had to adapt to wherever they settled. So again, adaptation became the main thing. When she came to New Orleans, she had to adapt to the surroundings, yet she knew which foods were biblically forbidden and were not used in her kitchen. Others she adapted to.
Well, you say that when your grandmother came to the United States, she still believed that tomatoes were poisonous.
Well, she had never food with tomatoes. Now, this was another thing that amazes you when you speak about adaption. She quickly learned to use the tomato. In fact, I think for years, I don't remember any roast coming out of the oven without a tomato sauce on it. But, I mean, she might have gotten a little carried away with it.
Well, tomatoes are the linchpin of Creole cooking.
Exactly, exactly. And so to this day, this is what we used to season a great thing. But the real seasonings, your oregano, your parsley, your thyme, all of those things that are so indigenous to the sauces and to the seasoning of Creole and Cajun, this is all kosher.
Of course, so, celery, bell pepper, and onions.
Exactly, and the celery and the garlic and all of that. It's just knowing what to blend with what.
Well, I know that you wrote, two of your books were entitled Kosher Creole Cooking and Kosher Cajun Cooking.
Mm-hmm.
The name jambalaya is said to come from the French word for ham, which is jambon, the African word
it's
for
African
rice.
For rice.
Yeah,
yes. Okay.
Exactly. And then the a la this and a la that. So it's ham with rice and a little bit of anything. What's jambalaya at your house?
Well, jambalaya is more than just the rice and ham. I mean, even the Cajuns and the Creoles, they put some chicken in it. They put seafood in it. They have shrimp jambalaya, everything like that. So when I make, there's a couple of jambalayas that I make. And my husband loved the one that had a tomato sauce base. And I use the chicken, kosher chicken, take some kosher sausage. When I say sausage right now, I'm really referring to something like a hot dog or a smoked sausage, which comes kosher. And the same in regular ingredients. I mean, certainly nothing wrong with the rice and all the seasoning. And you have the same identical jambalaya. In that case, it really isn't altering the recipe at all. It's simply using a kosher chicken versus one that is not kosher.
I know that it's not kosher to eat shellfish, so crawfish and shrimp are out too.
That's out.
Right?
Lobster, so all of that is out.
How did you cope with that?
There were many recipes that we could substitute things for. There are some recipes that we simply did not include a certain ingredient. There were others that we didn't touch with a 10-foot pole because we didn't know enough about it. I knew nothing about lobster. I knew nothing about crawfish. I knew nothing about the oyster liquid. So any recipes that we might have wanted to convert or to adapt to the kosher kitchen, if it required, if that was one of the major ingredients, we steered away from it because it was not something that we knew would come out tasty or, you know, the main ingredient lacking, it is not good. But there were so many other things where we substituted pieces of fish. We could substitute chicken. Or as I said before, there's some things that if you eliminated it, as long as you had that spice and the real seasoning there, that one ingredient was not missed.
Well, you are here for a seasonal reason. Can you tell us about Hanukkah at your house? What's a New Orleans Hanukkah like?
Well, I can tell you. Hanukkah is the holiday that I think is the best one to really celebrate here in New Orleans for several reasons, culinary-wise. We are so known for our fried foods. And this, when you have to fry, what do you need? Your basic ingredient is oil. And when you speak of oil, this is what Hanukkah is about. What we do on Hanukkah is our famous potato latke, which is like a crepe or a pancake, and it's dropped into the oil. But when I think of Hanukkah in New Orleans and all the things that we can do, I have made carrot fritters, apple fritters, banana fritters, corn fritters, all these great New Orleans and Southern fritter kind of thing that you boom, drop into that hot oil. It's the oil that is symbolic of Hanukkah. So there's a lot more affinity here with the Hanukkah celebration food-wise. I can't think of a better place of frying than down here.
Well, Mildred, I am so honored to have this opportunity to say Happy Hanukkah.
Well, thank you. Same to all of you all.
And thanks so much for coming in to talk with us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Mildred Covert, cookbook author and New Orleans' most celebrated kosher cook. Michael Twitty is a complicated and fascinating man. He's a writer, a culinary historian, and a historical interpreter who's dedicated to preserving and promoting African American foodways, always with an eye on authentic African origins. Michael is also a Judaic studies teacher in Washington, D.C. Michael, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Well, thank you so much, Poppy.
I'd like to start by having you walk us through your voyage that led to you discovering your Jewish faith. When and how did this all come together?
Well, when I was about 7 years old, I grew up with my feet in many different places, one of which was a neighborhood in the Washington, D.C. area called Kent Mill. And Kent Mill now, even more so, is basically an Orthodox Jewish neighborhood. And I grew up on the edge of that neighborhood, and you played in the sukkah, you know, in the fall. And all that got into me somehow. When I was 7 years old, I told my mother I was Jewish. And my mother thought that was really odd. But she let me be Jewish for a week. And it ended abruptly when I was told that I had to go to the doctor's office for a certain operation. Oh, yeah, my mother knew how to pull all the stuff. I mean, I grew up in a nominally Christian household. Neither one of my parents at that time in the game was really that church-going, that religious. And, you know, my grandmother was far more spiritually Christian than anything else. She certainly believed in the what I call the old religion, which y'all have a lot of down in New Orleans.
Yes, we do. So what happened to bring you back to that seven-year-old wanting to be Jewish, Michael?
I never really lost that interest. And I describe it as more of someone who just kind of shifts their place as opposed to someone who just makes a leap. You know, I did imbibe a lot of the black church growing up. But later on, when I was more in college and I did a lot of programs with black Jewish relations, you know, I knew this stuff. I knew so much stuff that we would go on synagogue visits. They would ask me, "Are you sure you're not Jewish?" And I said, "No, I'm sure I'm not Jewish, but wait a minute, but you know," and that it's very funny how insider cultural knowledge often people assume you got to be that thing, that person, that identity, to know so much. But it came down to a point where I just kind of felt uncomfortable not being involved in the cycle of holidays. I studied so much that it began to become a part of me in a way that I had not anticipated, that I did not really understand. So, lily pad to lily pad, I ended up at the synagogue where I converted, which is the Magen David Sephardic Congregation.
So, that's really where you find the African strain of Judaism in the Sephardic concentration of the religion?
It's much closer. It's much closer. I mean, thinking that there were African Jewish communities into what is now Mali in northern Nigeria and other parts of West Africa, all of whom probably originated somewhere in Morocco and North Africa, and everywhere these people went, eventually you ended up looking like people you settled among. You know, that's a big part of it. But it's even more salient to me because you go to Cuba, there are black Jews in Cuba, in Brazil, in corners of the world you never thought. You know, I was looking through a catalog, as it were, of free black families in antebellum Charleston. You would not believe how many of them had the last name Levy or Cohen.
Wow. And were some of the black Jews also enslaved peoples?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. No doubt about it. In fact, there's one document from the very beginning of the transatlantic slave trade that talks about how a lot of the communities in what is now the Sahel region of West Africa were eradicated and sold into slavery.
This is such a fascinating story, and the analogy that you make about the history of African Jews being braided together, just like the challah. It's so evocative.
Well, I mean, it's two parts of a whole. I call it blending tones. You know, how do we survive? How do we survive using humor, using food, using spirit, using the will to overcome, as opposed to fusing? You know, and when we fuse stuff, it's almost kitschy, it's almost funny, it's almost corny. Mm-hmm. When we like, mix the tones together, that's when we get the deeper meaning of who we are.
Well, Michael, now you've gone so far in this path that you are a Judaic studies high school teacher. And mm-hmm. I'd love to hear a little bit about what you teach there. And in particular, I heard that one of the things you teach your students is about kosher slaughter. So can we talk about that?
Yes. you have to understand, most of my students are Reform. Okay?
Uh-huh.
They're Reform Jews who do not observe kashrut. And when I talk to them about kosher slaughter, they're fascinated by it, but also I give them the hint of, well, look at what this means. So most of my kids are not going to switch around and observe kosher laws because, you know,
yeah.
They're not. But here's what it does. It opens up the classroom to a discussion on ethical eating, on consumption. Do we think about the animals that we consume? Do we think about how they're raised? So you can have this amazing discussion all about not just how a kosher slaughter takes the animal out, but in a spiritual way, but also talk about how we should, in fact, think about our food and where it comes from and honoring the life that is in our food. And so when it comes to that, then it's whole this meta-discussion that really opens up the gates to a whole new set of questions. And that's just when the classroom is set on fire, and it's a good day.
It's so fascinating that the very, very modern ideas of where your food is coming from and how ethically it's produced figures into this very ancient practice. I'm sure that to these high school kids, it must suddenly make connections in their brains.
Oh, yeah. We did a whole class where we talked about what does all this mean? How do we fit into this new food movement? And by the way, we asked the question, if a kosher slaughtering company is unethical, is the meat still kosher? The answer is, if you don't treat the people right and you don't treat the animals right, you can have a million rabbis say it's okay, but it's not okay if the labor involved are disrespected. If the animals' lives are not given their due respect, then it is not kosher.
Well, let's switch into some holiday talk, Michael. Tell me about how you celebrate Hanukkah.
Well, Hanukkah is a minor holiday. My favorite holidays are actually Passover, Simchas Torah, when we dance the Torah scrolls in Sukkot. But Hanukkah is fun because Hanukkah is, now we have the joke, right? Christmas, Kwanzaa, Hanukkah, whatever. It's like just kind of like honoring everybody's stuff.
Yeah.
Everybody has stuff going on this time of year. And I actually celebrate Kwanzaa as well, by the way.
Okay. Well, so, you just must be one party animal during the month of December, huh?
I know. It just never ends. It really never ends. And, of course, you know, I'm still around my mom and my family for Christmas time, albeit it has a totally different meaning to me. I guess here's the best way to say it. The food that I put out in my own personal circle and setting is an invitation to this complex identity we've been talking about. If people cannot understand or comprehend me on any other level, they can understand me through my plate. You know, I've really focused my energy on a very well-known West African proverb, sit at my table and you shall know me.
So tell me, what do you serve? What's on that plate?
Well, this will make you happy. I am not a sufganiyot, a jelly donut person. I do beignets.
You do beignets.
Fried donut, yes. I didn't know when I was down there. The Café Du Monde was kosher certified as well. And I was introduced to them by a friend of the family. She was from Louisiana. And she brought a box back to my mother. Mother said, I don't know what to do with this. So she handed it to me. This was when I was a teenager.
Uh-huh.
And I just mixed them up and did all that. And I've since learned how to make them from scratch. And I just thought, this is perfect. It's cooked in oil. It's southern. You can cook it up. It's it warms you up in the cold. It's just a really good match. But I also make a West African-style brisket. The Trinity goes into that with a lot of hot pepper, a lot of tomato, a lot of green pepper, green onion, the whole deal. But also, you know, I rub it down with a spice mixture that's classic Nigerian called suya, which is kind of like berberi in Ethiopia or curry traditions in India. It's a really good meat spice mixture that you kind of like rub and let sit on the meat, and you can grill it or you can slow bake it. And I do a little bit of both. I kind of par grill it, and then I let it sit around for a while. Hanukkah gives me the opportunity to build new family and new connections. Christmas is my time with my family. Kwanzaa is my time with my community. Hanukkah is my time with my Jewish family, people who have helped me in my journey from my conversion onward, kids who I've taught, families who I have deep connections with, and it's really that kind of thing of not just a connection with food or, you know, family, but just the fact that our arms are never too wide to embrace each other.
So, Michael, I just want to end by wishing you a very happy Hanukkah, a happy Kwanzaa, and just the best of all the holidays to you.
Well, thank you so much, and same to you.
African-American Judaic writer and culinary historian Michael Twitty.
What exactly is that mincemeat pie on your holiday table? Stay tuned, and we'll demystify mincemeat when we come right back.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets.
Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. What exactly is in that mincemeat pie on your holiday table? Well, the pie most likely contains a mixture of apples, currants, raisins, and other dried fruits that are combined with spices and a generous dose of liquor. That's a pretty tame version of the original mincemeat, which dates back to the time of the Crusaders. Way back then, real meat like goose, venison, or beef were minced and became what was called mincemeat. But the most important element was suet. Suet is beef or mutton fat taken from around the kidneys and loins and highly prized by pastry chefs. Shredded suet was stirred into the mincemeat, which then simmered for hours so the suet would melt, sealing the mixture so that it could be jarred safely for months. Mincemeat pies of the Middle Ages were religious affairs. 13 ingredients were used to represent Jesus and his apostles. The pies were rectangular, which was meant to symbolize the nativity manger, and then topped with a pastry baby Jesus. Sounds a bit like king cake to me. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Odds are good that your Louisiana Christmas table will include spinach madeleine. This creamy, slightly spicy side dish became popular after the recipe appeared for the first time in the first edition of River Road's Recipes. This best-selling community cookbook was originally published by the Baton Rouge Junior League in 1959. To hear the story of how it was created, we went straight to the source and spoke with its originator, Madeleine Wright, at her St. Francisville home.
Well, it was kind of by accident, actually. I was serving my two-table bridge club for lunch, and I made a cream spinach And I had this jalapeno cheese I had bought and didn't know what to do with it. I think it had first come on the market. It must have been about 1956. And I just wanted to use it for something, so just on a fluke, I decided to put it in the cream spinach. And something wonderful happened. My friends raved about it at first, and then I served it to a supper club, and the men liked it. And just at that time, the Junior League decided to publish a cookbook, and we were required to turn in three recipes. So spinach was the only thing that I had really created. I didn't consider myself a fine cook. I knew enough to know that if you make a cream sauce and you put cheese in it, it becomes au gratin. So that gave me the courage to put the jalapeno cheese into the cream spinach.
And then you just named it for yourself?
Well, actually, I did. I've always been a little bit embarrassed over that. But I have a philosophy that a name for a dish is very important. And they all have a certain rhythm to the title. Look at shrimp remoulade, oysters Rockefeller, Caesar salad, steak Diane. They all have this little rhythm to them. But anyway, I was looking for a name for my spinach and came across a recipe in a French cookbook that I have for a veal madeleine.
Yeah.
So I said to myself, why not to spinach Madeleine?
And the rest is history, huh?
That's right.
So when did you first discover you had such a winner on your hands?
Well, only when people started telling me that. And the book sales picked up. And there have been people who said that the recipe is what sells the book. I don't believe that because we had a very active committee of Junior League members who in the beginning took their cookbook samples with them everywhere they traveled and introduced them to the hotel gift counter or whatever, and they promoted the book very faithfully.
Well, one of the ingredients listed is spinach liquor. Maybe you should explain what that is.
Well, we've had a lot of fun with that too. The liquor that the vegetables are cooked in is an old-fashioned Southern name. And I put that in, and I think I called it vegetable liquor. It was just the juice off of the spinach, which was to go into the white sauce. And we've had a lot of fun because most of the young people don't know what that means. They don't associate liquor with vegetables. Actually, I have a friend whose daughter was off at school. Actually, she was at the University of Arkansas, and she wanted to make the spinach madeleine. So she went to the liquor store to get this vegetable liquor. And the clerk there said, well, he didn't have any spinach liquor, but that he'd recommend she use bourbon because it was made out of corn.
Okay, here comes the tough question now. What do you do now that Kraft has discontinued making that essential spinach madeleine ingredient, jalapeno cheese?
Well, I'm using that new one. Somebody up in Minnesota, I believe it is, a company called Parker Company, has started making a jalapeno cheese, and they have packaged it kind of like the original Kraft product, which was a little roll of cheese. About 5 or 6 inches long.
Mm-hmm.
And Parker Company is making this one similar to that. It doesn't produce exactly the same results as the Kraft product did.
Oh,
this,
dear.
This is the best substitute that I have found. It's to use, and all the grocery stores in this area at least stock that now.
There is an article online that claims that the dish came from the Green Springs Inn by a woman named Madeleine Neville?
Well, that is I. You see, I've had three husbands.
Okay.
I'm in the River Road. There's Madeleine. I think I'm Mrs. William Raymond in that book. But we weren't progressive enough to use the woman's name. We were always Mrs. somebody or other. But then I married this Texas Aggie whose name was Neville. And when we moved over here, I opened a bed and breakfast. I had divorced that first husband, as I told you, and found myself in a jam. But I opened a bed and breakfast here, and I named it Green Springs Inn. So I did serve it some, but I truthfully got tired of seeing that on the breakfast plate every morning.
That will happen. Well, Mrs. Wright, I want to thank you so much for talking with us on Louisiana Eats.
Well, thank you very much, and the same to you and all the listeners.
Madeline Wright of St. Francisville, Louisiana, creator of Spinach Madeline. When Kraft Foods discontinued the jalapeno cheese roll that inspired Madeline Wright's original Spinach Madeline, it caused great panic amongst Louisiana's Spinach Madeline lovers. There simply would be no Christmas without Spinach Madeline on the dinner table. Never fear, there is a way to recreate the original by using fresh chopped jalapenos, which frankly sounds better to me anyway. That said, there's no way to get around incorporating that favorite American processed food, Velveeta. To make spinach madeleine, first cook a couple of packages of frozen chopped spinach. Drain the spinach, but hang on to that cooking liquid. You'll need it later in the recipe. Then you make a roux by cooking flour and butter together until the raw flour taste disappears. You're not browning the roux. This is a classic French blonde roux, which takes about 3 to 4 minutes to make. Add the onion and cook it until it softens. Then whisk in about a half cup of the spinach cooking liquid, whisking until it's all smooth. Add celery and garlic salt, the jalapeno peppers, and the cubed Velveeta cheese. Keep stirring until the cheese melts, then stir in the spinach. Season with salt, red pepper, and Worcestershire sauce, and serve it right away, or put it in a buttered casserole dish topped with buttered breadcrumbs. Then it can keep overnight in the fridge, or even be frozen for later use. Spinach Madeline is good on crackers, and fabulous in a stuffed baked tomato. For a copy of this recipe, visit our website at itsneworleans.com or at wwno.org. I'm Poppy Tooker, and Spinach Madeline is real Louisiana Eats. There's lots of ways to celebrate the holidays in your own hometown. But if you're looking for a holiday getaway, our Louisiana Eats roving reporter has a great idea. On a recent trip through central Louisiana, Jill Benson stopped in Natchitoches for a charming holiday getaway not too far from home.
Christmas is big business in Natchitoches. On the Saturday before Thanksgiving, they light their annual holiday display. And their holiday display now encompasses the entirety of the historic district, with particular concentration around the river. So it's really spectacular with these lights shining off the water. And Natchitoches is such a picturesque, beautiful old town, and it's scrubbed to absolute pristine cleanliness.
And there's 300,000 lights in the display?
300,000 lights, and then they have 100 artistic displays scattered around town, again, with a concentration around the river, and all of those are lit up as well. I think I saw Santa pulling a sleigh in the river. Perhaps he was on the riverbanks, but when they threw the switch the Saturday before Thanksgiving, they started it off with this massive fireworks display. The population of Natchitoches is about 18,000 people.
Uh-huh.
This swells by an additional 30,000 the night that they light the Christmas display. And then the first weekend of December is their actual Christmas festival, when the town packs in an additional 100,000 people. Over the course of 6 weeks that this Christmas celebration goes on, it's estimated that they bring in 500,000 people.
So where did you stay when you were there?
I stayed at Maison Louisiane, and this was an interesting story. It's an historic structure. It's a beautiful old Victorian home, and it had fallen into disrepair and had been ignored, and it was acquired by the bank. And a lawyer by the name of Dan Dice bought the building. And in 2 months, he pumped about $300,000 into this and turned it around in 2 months.
Well, I guess if you know you've got a 500,000 people potentially coming to sleep over, it gives you a lot of impetus to get a move on.
You're motivated. Absolutely. And I was really impressed with this place because full respect was paid to the architectural gifts of this building. But the best part is the innkeeper. She's this young woman. She must be the youngest and most beautiful innkeeper in the state of Louisiana. Her name is Tiffany Hudson. And she was working on a degree in HRT and marketing at Northwestern University. She wrote a marketing plan. It was a fictitious marketing plan on Maison Louisiane because it was unoccupied. It had fallen into disrepair. And she wrote about how she would bring it back and revitalize it, what she would do to market it. Picked up an A for the class, left, and moved to Shreveport. And then about 3 months ago, just by chance, strangers put her together with Dan Dice. And she now has her dream job of implementing this plan with this man to bring this building that she was so impassioned by back to life. And they're doing an amazing job. She's a wonderful cook. So the food that you have at this bed and breakfast is rather extraordinary.
Well, it sounds like maybe Tiffany's a psychic, too.
Okay, it could be.
That's just amazing. Speaking of food, I bet you there were some yummy things to eat.
There were some yummy things to eat. Lazione's is a perennial favorite in Natchitoches, known for their meat pies, of course. And that's a little mom-and-pop operation that started up a long time ago. It's a little rags-to-riches story, and they've done very, very well. They have a crawfish pie on the menu now, too.
Yum.
And Lazione's, as usual, is just absolutely packed to the rafters. When I was there, I had the meat pie and dirty rice plate, and it was served with this delicious gravy. And you pour the gravy over everything, and then you retire to your room and clutch your stomach. But my favorite thing that I had to eat when I was there, my friend Iris Harper turned me on to this. It's called the Wookie, and it's at the pub in downtown Natchitoches. And it's a pile of hand-cut French fries slathered with brisket debris, and then heaps of melted cheese on top of that.
Oh, it sounds like something that could sustain the whole football team up there.
Indeed, I believe it could.
Now, all of this incredible Christmas fun is free once you get there.
It is absolutely free, and the entire town of Natchitoches participates. So while the bulk of this is around the historic district, people really take pride in this. All of the homes are beautifully decked out for Christmas. There's caroling everywhere in their little parks and squares. There are lots of different things going on, little impromptu celebrations with a holiday theme. This is a great Louisiana freebie.
Well, I'm jumping in the car and getting on the trail of lights, meat pie in hand.
Don't forget those Wookie fries, Poppy. Stop at the pub for the Wookie.
Our Louisiana Eats roving reporter, Jill Benson. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Next week, we'll remember Michael Mazelle Nelson and take one last streetcar ride with our friend.
You could bring crabs, you could bring, and then again, these could be live crabs caught out at West End if you're catching the West End car to go back to town. You could bring shrimp, but you are not allowed to bring crawfish. And I asked him about that, and his memory is that there is fear of some virus that caused the health department to say, no crawfish.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by Dickie Brennan and Company and Linda Green, the Yakaman Lady Soul Food Catering. Our media sponsor is Louisiana Life Magazine, the magazine of a great state. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Thanks to executive producer Thomas Walsh and sound engineer Joe Schreiner. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.